This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, let's assume Kelly Jensen is right. This fight isn't so much about the kids as it is about their parents. A projection of their fear, anger, or angst that their children are being taught something they don't believe by people they don't trust. Those feelings were a marquee issue during last fall's gubernatorial race in Virginia.
I'm not going to let parents come into schools and actually take books out. I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach.
That was then Democratic candidate and former governor Terry McAuliffe making a comment that then GOP candidate, now governor Glenn Youngkin, would turn into an overblown but effective battle cry.
Virginia's kids can't wait any longer because Terry McAuliffe's program that he specifically acknowledged, he believes that parents do not have a right to be engaged in their kids' education. In fact, he wants government to stand between parents and their children.
The telling verb here is engaged. The school board showdowns across the country in the past year aren't showcasing parents engaging with their children's education, but seeking to limit it, to remove whatever from science or history or English class that makes them uncomfortable or might make their kids uneasy. But in the debates over curricula, there remains a fundamental legal loose end. Who does decide what to teach kids? How much do parental rights figure into the mission of public education in American democracy? Jennifer Berkshire and Jack Schneider are hosts of the education podcast Have You Heard? And co-authors of the Washington Post article, Parents Claim They Have the Right to Shape Their Kids' School Curriculum. They don't.
Parents do have rights, and they can make choices. Their rights have been very clearly defined legally. They can, for instance, withdraw their kids from the public education system and send them to a private school. But parents aren't the only ones with rights. Children themselves have a right to an education, and parents do not simply have property rights over their children. Their children are both independent actors who need to be treated with dignity and respect and who have a right to be exposed to ideas that may not align with the ideas that they're exposed to at home. And they are future citizens who we all have a stake in.
In your piece, you guys wrote that common law and case law in the U.S. have long supported the idea that education should prepare young people to think for themselves, even if that runs counter to the wishes of parents. And you quote the legal scholar Jeff Shulman, who said, "This effort may well divide child from parent, not because socialist educators want to indoctrinate children, but because learning to think for oneself is what children do." Okay. What is the common law and case law? How do we see it play out?
The system is not designed to alienate young people from whatever values and beliefs they're exposed to at home. For the most part, that isn't really what happens. But in cases where parents, let's say, don't want young people exposed to even basic things like the ability to read and write, the compelling state interest in preparing somebody to participate as an equal member in a democratic republic trumps those parental desires to, let's say, shield a young person from the world.
And that's implicit in the law that requires kids to be educated up to a certain age.
Right. It's a part of legal interpretations there, right? It doesn't say in state constitutions that if parental desires conflict with this law, then parents lose, right? That's a part of what courts have wrestled with over the years. And sometimes they've struck compromises, like in the Supreme Court's Yoder decision, where they upheld the fact that there is a compelling state interest in young people receiving an education, but also respected the Amish desire to not send their kids to school past a certain age.
Now, in the Post piece, again, you wrote that U.S. law has long supported the idea that education should prepare young people to think for themselves, even if that runs counter to the wishes of parents. Can you give some examples of that?
The teaching of evolution. Ultimately, the desires of parents from particular religious backgrounds and traditions did not win out over right of schools to teach what's in accordance with science. A parallel example today would be teaching climate change. There are certainly parents less likely because of their religious backgrounds than because of their political persuasions who don't want climate change being taught as a fact. They don't want it being taught at all. Schools do not need to then stop teaching climate science merely because some parents find it to be in violation of their political ideology.
Jennifer, you wrote that this actually isn't the first time we've seen a push for parents' rights, that we saw this happening back in the 90s, for instance.
What's amazing is if you start poking around in the 90s, you'll find, you know, an unbelievable amount of media coverage of the parent rights issue, including by columnists who are still writing today. A lot of it started as the culture changed to include, you know, more recognition of gay and lesbians. And so there was a big backlash in New York City against what was known as a rainbow curriculum and the idea that kids were going to be reading books like Heather Has Two Mommies. Parents felt like they were losing control over the ideas that their kids were being exposed to. There was a deep-pocketed, well-organized push to get parents' rights language on the books in every state. And then it ran out of steam for reasons that I think are really instructive for us today.
Mm-hmm.
One of them I learned about reading a George Will column. He was very concerned that putting language like this in constitutions would set off an explosion of litigation. And he asked, you know, do we really want to turn every parent's cultural grievance into a lawsuit? And so the movement ran up against another pet GOP cause at the time, which was tort reform, right? Fast forward to today, you know, we've already seen this just explosion of these education gag orders across the country. It's very much a wedding of what law professor John Michaels describes as the industrial grievance complex with the school wars. There was one that was rolled out in Oklahoma just this week that if a teacher teaches something that goes against a child's religious beliefs, that the teacher will have to pay $5,000 out of his or her own money. And if the teacher is found to have been the beneficiary of something like a GoFundMe, or, you know, an organization stepped in, that teacher will lose their license in Oklahoma for 5 years. So it's this incredible yoking of this moment of grievance to really encouraging people to become their own private litigators. And, you know, these bills, these education gag orders, now affect a third of the students in the country.
And this is not really a new strategy. If you go back to the 1960s, you can read historian Richard Hofstadter writing about what he called the paranoid style in American politics. And he was talking about the Goldwater movement, but it really applies today. His assessment of how much political leverage, I think was his phrasing, can be got out of the animosities and passions of a small minority if you present to them a kind of all-powerful boogeyman. That's why I think that Jennifer and I tend to see this as a cynical political movement, because it's politically effective, but it's not in response to any major shifts in the rights that parents have had historically versus the rights they have now, or really the basic ways that schools are operating.
Why do so many core debates in our country, end up in school board meetings?
Well, one reason is that young people enrolled in the schools who are today ages 5 to 18, 10 or 20 years from now, they'll not only be voting, many of them will be running for offices and will be voting for them. A second reason for this is there are roughly 100,000 public schools across the United States, and these are simultaneously government institutions. They are institutions that belong to local communities. They are manifestations of our public life together. And given the decline over the past several decades in civic associations and in other forms of public life, the schools are often the only place where people are coming together and engaging in these kinds of civic activities.
Are there a ton of parents fighting for their kids to learn history and science, fighting for books to stay on shelves and in curricula?
We see polls that show that the number of parents who want their kids to be exposed to quote-unquote honest accounting of history, that they far outnumber the parents whose voices are so loud in this debate. But the problem is that the kinds of scenes we've been witnessing at these school board meetings, I have talked to people all over the country who describe the demoralizing effect of being shouted down, you know, of being too fearful to speak up at a meeting. They really have an anti-democratic effect. What's troubling is that as things move on to the book banning phase, often you have students speaking out and saying, I need to be exposed to ideas like this. They're going to end up on the receiving end of this kind of anti-democratic action, which I think sends a powerful signal that you're better off just not speaking up. So the loudest voices at that public comment section of the school board meeting, often it's the woman at the Virginia meeting who says, you know, we're coming back and we're bringing our guns.
So there are a ton of parents who feel it's important for their kids to learn history and science, but they aren't loud enough.
I think that that's really true. And I think the other thing that's going to be very interesting to watch is the more these bans go into effect, limiting what kids can learn, the more kids' own futures are going to be limited. And at a certain point, the affluent suburban parents who we complain about so much that they do everything they can to gain advantage for their kids, well, at a certain point, it's going to, you know, make a difference in something like an AP test or a college admission. They're going to end up learning less as a result. Once parents start to process that, the real backlash to this is going to happen. We've already seen this in states where, you know, legislators have really pushed to defund public schools for ideological reasons. There's a certain point where parents who have not been involved before start to see that this is making a difference for the worse in their own kids' lives. And that's where the backlash really picks up steam.
Jack, Jennifer, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having us.
It was great to be here.
Jennifer Berkshire and Jack Schneider are hosts of the education podcast, Have You Heard? And co-authors of the book, A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door, The Dismantling of Public Education and the Future of School. Coming up, the historic lawsuit over censorship one kid was born to bring. This is On the Media.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.